I worked under a program that was federally funded to place nurses in the agricultural community to do several things. One, to track farm injuries and illnesses, which was not previously well tracked, because I think the farming community in some ways are very, what shall I say, closed among themselves. Farm families tend not to seek medical treatment as readily as other populations of people, and farm families live very frugally sometimes, and don't take advantage of community services the way they could. And sometimes accidents happen on farms, and unless it's a really, really serious accident or illness or a death, you don't always hear about it. So the federal government was very interested in learning about these illnesses and accidents that happen on farms. So our first purpose was to take a certain area. There were nurses in 15 states that were assigned to work with farm families. There were four nurses in the state of New York, one in the southern part of the state, Long Island area, and believe it or not, there were farms out there. I learned a lot about farming when I took this job. And then there was one in the eastern part, the Adirondack area, and the very eastern part of the state. And I was in central New York, and there was a nurse also in the western part of the state. And I learned that New York is a very diversified state agriculturally. Even though we have big cities in the state of New York, we also have a lot of farming here. And we also grow a lot of crops here. So we have dairy farming and crop farming and grain farming. And it's amazing, you know, how much of the state produces farming products and things like that. So I had 15 counties in upstate New York, including the county I live in, and several counties out toward the west until the area where the western nurse took over. And we subscribed to a news reporting, a news gathering organization that would actually send me things that were in area papers that I might not necessarily see, and they would send me reports of farm accidents. And then I would go out, and I went with a social worker. It was a social worker and a nurse that worked together, and it was actually wonderful. We got to go on the road and drive in the country almost every day of our work, and it was really great. And I established a very close relationship with the social worker as well, who's still a very good friend of mine. And we would visit these families unannounced because we didn't want them to worry or have fear that we were just being nosy. So we would visit a family and express our concern about how the family was, particularly if it was a serious accident or a serious illness. And a lot of people don't know this, but farmers can, there are a lot of deadly gases that are involved in farming. And I know several people who have lost family members because of these gases that occur in farming. And of course, the equipment they work with can be the reason for accidents. And they can be very maiming accidents or even deaths when they have these accidents. So we tracked those and made sure the family got the services that they needed. And encourage them to take advantage of those services available in their communities. And mental health is another thing that they deal with too, and you know, they needed to take advantage of those services that they can get from their communities. In addition to collecting information, we also did a lot of farm safety teaching. And the whole staff at NICAM, the New York Center for Agricultural Medicine and Health, worked together at farm fairs, the state fair, and local county fairs. We would go to those fairs and hand out safety information about farming, about having rollover protection on your tractors, and about wearing sunblock for skin cancer, because skin cancer is a big issue with farming. And we would do skin checks on people, free, and offer whatever services we could to help farmers and farm families. We also had a children's program for children's safety, because a lot of farm families, you know, ride children on tractors. You probably have seen it yourself, you know, and that's can be very unsafe. And so we discouraged having children ride on machinery unless they actually had a proper safe seat, just like we have safe seats in cars now.
Right.
And so we did a lot of teaching and a lot of checking. We did lung treatments. I shouldn't say lung treatments. We did lung evaluations for farmers. And if they needed help, we had doctors right here at Bassett who knew a lot about farming and knew about a lot about the conditions that farmers have, and that things that could help them.
Was there something specific you had to do in order to get certified for this agricultural nursing?
We did have a certification, yes, that was developed. It was kind of a new thing, you know, when I started it, when I started working in this. But there is a certification, and there's also a certification in, what is it called? In workplace safety. Not just farming. I mean, in industrial workplace, and places like, you know, factories that nurses get involved with now. So nursing is an amazing occupation, because you can go in lots of different directions with it. And I've told my kids, you know, it's a great career to think about, because there's so many opportunities in nursing. Anyway, so that's my story with NICAM. Wonderful people worked in that field. I met wonderful people, farmers and farm families. Wonderful, wonderful group of people. And I learned a lot about living in the country and, you know, the families that live here and live on the land. And that was another wonderful experience. Anyway, while I was working at NICAM, I was introduced to my present husband, Ed, by a couple that I've known most of my life. The wife had gone to high school with me. And they introduced me to Ed, who was living in New Jersey in the area where I had grown up. I didn't know him then when I lived there. But he had raised his family there, and his first wife at the age of 40 had developed Lou Gehrig's disease. And so I didn't know her either, but my understanding is that that disease, you know, gradually gets worse and there's no cure. And she died when she was 45 years old. So we met in 1993, and I was 53 years old and he was 51. And the following year, we got married. It's interesting stories about when we met and when we got married. He had 3 children, I had 4. And they were of similar ages and all grown up. Everybody was out of college. Everybody was on their own. And Ed and I developed this kind of long-distance relationship where, you know, one weekend he would come here and another weekend I would go there to New Jersey. And we did that for almost a year. We got married on April 30th, 1994, here in Cooperstown.
How did the family, the rest of your families, seem about when you guys were dating and then married?
Oh, I think it's interesting. To step ahead a little bit, I mean, everyone, the children all get along well. Now they all have their own families. At the time, I only had 1 grandchild, and now we have 15. And we do call all the kids our own. My former husband died a few years ago, so and he was included in the family group, too. We were all very friendly, which was really nice for all the kids. Ed's kids knew my first husband. And whenever we had a family gathering, we always included him in the family gathering. So it was very, very nice. In fact, my kids thanked me and thanked Ed for that friendly relationship because it made it easier for everybody. And it was good. It was good. I liked it that way, too. When we first met, Ed's wife had been deceased for 4 years. And I had been divorced for a few years. My kids were, I would say, very enthused that I had met someone. Ed's kids, his youngest child, Peter, was the same age as my youngest child, Amy. And I would say that he was just out of college and still living at home. And he... I think he was very enthused for his father, that his father met someone that he could be happy with. And his oldest son, Eddie, was living in Arizona. So I didn't get to meet him at first. And he came for the first time at Christmas time. He came home to be with his dad at Christmas time. And I met him then. And I only really was in his company a few times before we got married. So I think it was a little harder for Eddie to get used to the idea that his father was moving on with his life. And his daughter, Michelle, Ed's daughter, Michelle, was studying for her doctorate in Hungary at the time. So I didn't get to meet her until Easter time, which was in April. And we were getting married on April 30th. So Michelle got to meet me right before we got married. And I think for his kids, it was a little harder. At least this is my interpretation. I don't know what they would tell you. But I was very conscious of the fact that this was definitely a transition for Ed and his family that had to be a little struggle. I know that they love their mom very much, and I understand that she was a wonderful person. And Ed told me that when he asked me to marry him. He said, "My first marriage was very happy, and I would like to be happy again," when he asked me to marry him. So we've even talked about the possibility of having... She's buried in New Jersey, and we've talked over the years about having her body brought here because Ed and I intend to be buried here when we die, and I think that she should be here too. So hopefully we'll all be buried together. Ed will be in the middle, his first wife on the left and mine on the right. I don't know one way or the other, but anyway. I think that loved ones who are deceased need to be honored, and she's down there in New Jersey, and no one's there anymore. So I guess I'm getting off the subject, but anyway. Over the years, we've developed wonderful, Ed and I both, I think, have developed wonderful relationships with each other's children, and it's good. It's all good, I would say. It's all good. In the meantime, we've had all these other grandchildren be born, and, you know, they know Ed as Grandpa, and his grandchildren know me as Grandma. And we've tried to, both of us have tried to keep it that way. And I know his grandchildren all know that they had a grandmother who died before they were born. And that's fine. That's good. And there is a grandchild also named after Ed's first wife, which I think is wonderful because, you know, people need to keep these loved ones in their memory. So it's good.
So Ed moved to Cooperstown right after you guys got married, or did it take
no.
a little while?
I actually moved back to New Jersey, where I grew up, to be with him because he was still working in a Wall Street business. He was actually working from home. He was, in 1993, right before I met him, he was in the World Trade Center when the bomb went off. May not remember that. I don't know how, if you were born then, but yeah, I guess you were born then.
Yeah.
1993.
Yeah, I would have been 4.
That was the first time there was an attack on the World Trade Center, and Ed was in the building at the time. And we were supposed to have met in January, and there was a big storm. This is 1993, backtracking to when we met. And our mutual friends were going to introduce us, and he was supposed to come here for a visit. And we had a big nor'easter snowstorm, and he canceled, and perfectly understandably that he canceled. And we didn't get to meet until June. But in the meantime, that incident at the World Trade Center had happened, and Ed was in the building at the time. And there were not only a few people killed in that, I think. And the bomb was in the basement, and he was on the 61st or 62nd floor, and he escaped. But it was frightening. It was very frightening. And that was in 93. In 94, in April, we got married, and he started working at home in his own financial business. And I think at the time, he thought that that we would live in the suburbs of New York City, but always have a presence here. I still had a home here. And that we talked about it once, and he said, well, you know, he said, this is where my business is, but, you know, we'll always have a presence in Cooperstown. And I did love living in Cooperstown, and I think in my heart, I hoped that we would come back someday. And then as the year 1994 went by and into 1995, the whole financial market started to change. And the business was not what Ed hoped it would be. So he started to think about the possibility of moving here and doing something entirely different. And I had actually had a little experience with B&B when I was in nursing. I started a little B&B business when I lived in Cherry Valley, New York, which is right here near here, and still worked as a nurse, but did a little B&B business on the side, on weekends and summers and things like that. So when we talked about what other business we might do if we came to Cooperstown, I naturally suggested that we do the B&B business. And I knew that Ed had the kind of personality that it took to be in the B&B business. He's a people person, and he's very hospitable and very charming and likes people. And that's when we decided to look for a place here in Cooperstown where we could do a B&B business. So we started to look for real estate. And of course, I lived in Cherry Valley, which is a little further out in the country. And I had all my favorite places all picked out in the country. And Ed, being the business-minded person he is, knew that we needed to be somewhere into the center of the tourist activity to make a business out of it. And so that's what we did. So we started looking for real estate. And this is my cat, Bootsy. we started looking around for real estate, and we looked at some houses out in the country and some in town. And as I said, Ed focused on the in-town real estate because he has a business mind. And so we did that. We decided on this house, and it was the belonged to the local dentist, who everyone in town knew, and came to the dentist here. And he had retired about 5 years earlier and had been renting the house as it was for sale. And it's funny because when I worked in Cooperstown as a nurse, I used to come through here all the time and saw this house and thought it was a nice house, but never actually dreamed I'd ever live here. So it was kind of interesting when we actually did buy this house. So we put Ed's house on the market in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and ended up renting that for several months before it actually sold. The renter actually ended up buying the house, and we sold the house that I had previously owned here and put all of our finances into this house. And started to make some changes in here to accommodate guests. And so we opened on Mother's Day weekend in 1996. And I remember we only had two rooms ready the first weekend that we opened, and we had two couples who came to watch their sons. They actually were from New Jersey, and they came to watch their sons play baseball on Doubleday Field. And we happened to have snow on Mother's Day weekend, and the games were canceled. And that was our first experience with B&B. I stayed up almost the whole night before they arrived, getting ready for them, and I was a nervous wreck. But it all worked out well. And then we grew from there. Every year we, you know, added more rooms, and worked very, very hard those first few years. And Ed did too. You know, doing the hospitality business. And we learned a lot as we went, I think.
How many people do you usually accommodate in a given summer?
Oh my goodness, the total number would be very hard for me to come up with, but on a daily basis, when at the peak of our season, we can have anywhere from 16 to 20 people every day for breakfast.
Wow.
So it's a busy concern, and you're busy all the time. One thing that I learned in the B&B business is that you work from the time you get up till the time you go to bed. That's pretty much it. But it's a pleasant business, and I always liked the idea of working at home. There's a part of my personality that really loves to be home, and I've always loved my home. My home has always been an important thing to me, and I think the B&B business, I know that I've always said this about the B&B business, that if your business is also your home, you have an opportunity to have a lovely home, because it has to be lovely if you're going to have guests here. And you can work at home, which is nice, and and still have it nice and have some tax write-offs and things like that, you know, and make a living out of your own home. So it's a nice home business. It really is. So that was 1994 when we opened, and we've continued to grow over the years. We added the two rooms in the carriage house. We do have a pool in the backyard, which was here when we bought the house, and we were very fortunate to have that because, believe it or not, people are attracted to this property because we have a pool. Although when they come here, they don't use it much. They think they're going to, but they don't. And except if there's kids in, you know, with them, then the kids will draw them into the pool. We knew right from the beginning that the B&B business, as it is today, had gotten to the point where the B&B business had grown and matured to the point where people were very happy to stay in a B&B, but they don't want to share bathrooms. And they want all of the amenities that you get in a hotel. But the ambiance of maybe a home. So we concentrated on making sure that every one of our guest rooms had a private bath. So we added lots of bathrooms. When we bought the house, there were already 4 or 5 bathrooms in the house. Now we have 11.
Wow.
So we've added all these bathrooms, including a separate powder room, because what we realized the first year that we were in business is that people would come on a given day, especially in the busy season, and they've been traveling a long way, and the first thing they want to use is a bathroom. And if their room wasn't ready for them to go in, if they show up early, they still want to use a bathroom, you know? And so we quickly realized that we had to have a public restroom that people could use as soon as they arrive, even if it wasn't the one they would have with their room. So we added a powder room early on. And as I said, every room has an in-room bathroom, which is what people want. And we concentrated on making a great breakfast every day. We have always served a full breakfast with fresh fruit and homemade muffins and a main dish and coffee and juice. And the other thing that we do, I think that's special here, is that we use fine china on the table, and we set the table as beautifully as we can, and always use cloth napkins and napkin rings. And we make it as pretty as we can, and we always serve a different breakfast to the guest every day. They never get the same breakfast twice, and they often never get the same dishes twice. We have lots of sets of china, and we try to do it differently every day, because when they come out, they go, oh, wow, that's really pretty, you know? In fact, guests come in and they'll see the table set for breakfast, and they'll say, do you serve dinner? No, that's for breakfast, we'll say. When we first opened for business, I was very, very particular about the table setting, and I'd be setting the table at like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and my husband would say to me, why don't you let our employees set the table? I said, because I'm fussy and I want it to be perfect. And I learned finally that I could allow the employees to set the table, with the one reserve that I could change anything I didn't like. And I've, over the years, gotten very used to the fact that that's actually a really fun thing for the employees to do as the last thing they do before they leave their jobs for the day. and they enjoy being